And good afternoon, folks. My name's Craig, and this is the Over the Fence show here on Raglan Community Radio 98.1 FM. And also going over to our friends, Free FM on 89.0, coming out of Kirikiriroa, going throughout the Tron. Hope you're having a lovely day out there, folks. It is very warm in sunshine. Beautiful spell of weather, hasn't it been lately? And by popular demand, we will be rejoined by Liz on the show again today, and we're going to be talking about compost, being International Compost Week starting, I think from today, I think it is, but there's a few events in that coming up, so we'll cover a few of those, but mostly I think we're going to be talking about compost on farm and uses in agriculture and things like that mostly, so that'll be later on the show. We'll do that. As for now, I'll come back some weather after this, but firstly I want to play you this one, Music Lovers. I played the studio version of it, of this single by Bo Diddley a few weeks ago, but here's one where he's, you know, singing and telling a story about his very first single. So I hope you enjoy it, Music Lovers.
This is the rhythm that shook the world. I want to tell y'all a little story here. Well, the story of Bo Diddley, how this whole thing came about. Well, in 1955, I walked into Chess Records one afternoon and I says, hey, the dude working there named Sonny. I said, hey, Sonny, baby. Y'all make records in here? He said, oh, I ain't the one you want to see. You want to see Mr. Chess. I said, well, he's the right dude if he's the big dude. He said, yeah, well, he's the one you want. So he called Leonard. He said, hey, Leonard, come out here. There's a cat out here with a guitar. I want to see you. So Leonard come out there and asked me, say, what can I do for you? I say, I don't know. I say, y'all make records in the air. He said, well, sometime we do and sometime we don't. What you want? I say, I want to make a hit record. He said, now ain't that nice. You want to make a hit record. What you got? I say, I got a tune that's hot, baby, hot. Let me hear a little of it. Then I said, okay. And the bow-legged rooster told the cock-legged duck, say you ain't good-looking, but you sure can crow. He said, wait a minute, son, we can't record that. I said, how come? He said, too rough. And he said, but go ahead. I said, okay. I'm neither an elephant, I made him stout. Broke through the door. Say, hey, Leonard, I got to have the told you, baby. Gotta get one. 1955, when Bo Diddley came alive. Shook the world with this wonderful beat. Oh, just make a patchy beat. Grab you, baby.
All right, thanks, everybody. That was Bo Diddley there with a little story he's telling about as how we went into recorders first ever song. And I'm going to play another tune now. I'll come back with the weather after this one, and this one is going to be a demo I came across of Forest by The Cure from 1980. Hope you enjoy it. and I'll probably come back some gardening to do after this beautiful song by Snapper called Gentle Hour. That was New Zealand band Snapper there with their song Gentle Hour. And now I'm going to play for you another tune from another New Zealand band called, we'll do this one actually, The Big Room by The Front Lawn.
Everybody, It's good to see you here, you people down the front, and you people way back there. You're out there in the dark, we're down here in the light, but we're here for the very same reason. There's a front lawn show tonight. Some of us shaved our faces, some of us cleaned our teeth, some of us drove a big flash car and parked it in the street. Some of us put on trousers, some put on perfume, but we're all in the same room, yeah, we're all in the same room. We're all in the same room. It's a big, big room. It's a big, big room. To the sound of many feet, flesh from every suburb has sweated in that seat. Many eyes have seen the glory, and many hearts have swelled. Many ears have heard the story, and many noses smell the smell of other people, the way they do their hair, how they find the seat to sit in, what they do when they get there. The smell of other people, the way they do their hair, how they find the seat to sit in, what do they do when they get there? Can you feel it? Yeah. Can you feel it? Can you feel it? Can you feel it? Oh, oh, oh. Angels and devils fill the air and turn us round and round and round. Come down, old ones, ancient spirits, come down. Come down, angels and devils fill the air and turn us round and round and round. Come down.
And there we are, folks. That was the big room there by the front lawn. Now we're joined in the studio now by our guest for today, back by popular demand, Liz. G'day, Liz. How are you?
Kia ora, Craig.
You used to grow tons of garlic.
Yes, we did. Yes, we still do. We're trying to nail how to grow garlic in Raglan without it getting the rust. So we've been trying a few different varieties and different ways of managing it. So it's a really interesting thing because I feel like the reason that the rust is there, well, I'm almost sure it's climate change.
Yes.
We've been growing stuff here for 30 years and people ask, you know, visitors and groups coming, what can you see as an effect of climate change? Mm-hmm. And definitely our challenges around growing the garlic's been one of them, and that when you unpack it and you look at why is the rust coming, the rust was always there, but it always used to come like in December at the end of the cycle. So the garlic would already, it'll be in its bulbing stage. So it doesn't really matter if the tops die off.
Yeah.
But the problems that we're having with the rust now are it's earlier in the spring, in the middle of the big growth period. So like October, September even, and it's connected to little heat waves that we have now in the spring, early spring. Like we can get days that go up to, you know, like upper 20s. And, of course, everyone goes, oh, it's lovely, you know, heat wave. Like it actually is nice for people, but plants, it's a bit of a screws them up, because then next week it'll be plummeting down to like 5 degrees again, you know, and we could be having lashing rain, and it really weakens their tissue, you know, their bodies, their leaves, and it makes them really prone to disease. And so then the rust, that also because of the warm period, the rust spores start proliferating on the grasses and things around. That spreads onto the garlic.
Yeah,
so it's a it's a climate connected thing.
Yeah.
And I haven't had big conversations with any other big growers about that. But yeah, I mean, I maybe I don't know what the big growers are doing, whether they're spraying fungicide on to stop it. I think in colder climates, maybe the South Island wouldn't have that so much of a problem because they're generally colder. So we're looking for like warmer varieties to grow.
Okay.
We did used to enjoy supplying Raglan with loads of garlic. Aaron, there's another grower, Aaron Laborier. He's still he's growing beautiful garlic. I think it's elephant garlic.
Like around here? Or?
I'm not sure where he's growing it now.
Yeah.
Maybe still up, used to be up Maunga Tawhiri Road.
Yeah.
I know he's was, maybe still is, a charter boat owner and got fish waste.
Okay.
And fed his garlic fish waste, which would be helpful because of all the minerals in it fungus infection.
Okay. Well, that'll lead us very nicely into what we're actually kind of going to be mostly talking about today, which is compost, of course, and it is, what, International Compost Week?
Starting
today or Saturday?
No. Well, for us, it starts Saturday. We're going to kick it off on Saturday with a workshop at Waitutuna School. And it's an opportunity to spend the afternoon with one of our local growers, Shai Broad, who's an amazing vegetable grower who will share his skills around hot composting. If you want to increase the amount of compost you make at home, maybe you're a lifestyle block, or you want to seriously get into growing stuff at home, learning how to make hot compost will be really helpful because it enables you to make larger amounts more quickly. So I highly recommend it. It's like 1:30 till 4, and it's at the Waitutuna School, and it's only $20, which is a real bargain because Shai is very, very knowledgeable, and you get to contribute to the Waitutuna School's Garden to Table program.
Yes, which I presume that'd be Kate Doom is running that.
So that's pretty cool that the community can learn and jump in and help them get their compost ready for the next growing season.
For sure, yeah.
So, have a look at the WEC Facebook page or website, or go, I know the tickets are on Humantics. That time's running out for that one, so please, if you're interested, it's Saturday, 1:30 till 4, get a ticket.
Absolutely, yeah. No, Shaw's
Waitatuna.
Shaw's very, very. She's been on the show before. Very good gardener. Knows a lot about gardening, so you'd learn a lot from him, folks, for sure. So you get along to that one.
You've seen his beautiful vegetables at the growers' market.
Yes.
That's the compost and the shy and skills, but you know, it all starts with the soil.
Yes, absolutely. And then, of course, on Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, is it, the compost clinic that you're running up at Extreme Zero Waste?
Yeah, I'm just going to be available up in the afternoon, so from 12:30 till 5, I'll be working up there with Rakai, who's usually always there on the afternoons.
Mm.
But I'll be there if anyone's got any questions or they want to have a bit of a look around, and explanations about how we make the compost up there. We're going to share some of that on a very nice casual basis. So you don't have to book in. There's not a set time. Just come on up.
Yeah.
If you're, you know, dropping off some green waste or going to the shop, swing by the organics yard on your way and I can, you know, I'll have a go at answering any questions. That's why we've called it a clinic.
A clinic?
To see, you know, worm farming, different kinds of composting, what we do at Extreme.
Mm.
I suppose I could extend that to gardening tips. yeah, and I'm going to try and get together some worms, harvest some worms as well, so that I can, if people want a few worms to start up a worm farm at home, I'll have like little starter packs.
Cool.
Of worms.
This is a bonus for you folks. Start your own wormies.
Yeah, but you have to come and talk to me.
And you do, is it hot and cold at Extreme, eh?
Yeah, we've got two systems. We've got the hot one with the food waste, which goes through the big concrete horizontal composting unit. And then we've got a cooler, longer, slower compost, which is just made with the shredded garden waste. So if you want to be in a very broadly, get two different products. The one that's done slowly is a much more fungal compost. So it's got a really high the microbes in it is a very high level of fungus. And that's really good for one. It's both of them are good for the soil, but for different purposes. And then the one that comes out of the hot composter is more of a bacterial process. It does get fungal towards the end as it cools down, and we do let it mature out on the pad, but that's so you end up with higher nutrients with the hot compost.
And I guess, I don't know, if you're putting it on your paddocks or whatever, say, you'd probably want to go for the hot one, right? You want probably a more bacterial than a fungus one, you reckon?
You'd sparingly use the one out of the hot composter has quite a lot of soluble nitrogen, so you could use it to get a flush, or with a crop that's a heavy feeder. But to build your soil, the one that's more of a fungal one would probably be better.
Because because a lot of people lime their farms and paddocks and things like that, and that lowers the has a negative effect on the fungal level in the soils, eh? Is that right?
Yeah. They don't operate at low pH.
You want
around neutral, really,
for all of
the microbes. So why do farmers lime again? Remind me.
It's lime is more. What are the nutrients?
Grasp.
I'm just trying to think, you know, what comes out of it, right? It's
phosphate.
It's phosphates and things like that, because you've put too much nitrogen on, other things don't work chemically in the soil, right?
Yeah.
So they apply lime and it boosts the, remember my blank here, one of those days. But
I do know really, but...
There's the calcium's and...
Your calcium's, of course, important from the lime. I feel like the lime is a bit of a band-aid to the fact that we put loads of synthetic fertilizer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm.
So you can actually balance soils with good compost and worm casts as well, help to get the soil to neutral.
Mm.
Like you can do it microbially. well. Like, I think lime's become a go-to. I think it might be in New Zealand soils related to phosphate as well, possibly.
Okay.
Releasing phosphate from the clay, breaking clay.
Yeah, I think yes, that rings a bell. Yeah.
And I know it helps to get rid of certain weeds that farmers in the past haven't wanted, like buttercups and plantain didn't used to be a thing.
Yeah.
Now it's a thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of plantain going in now.
People used to look at our field paddocks at home. We haven't got many, and go, oh, it's 50% plantain. Yeah. What do you want that for? You know, that's not grass. But now I'm hearing, you know, people have learned that plantain is really beneficial for the animals and the soil you know, keep the soil healthy and for life, mine the nutrients out.
And dock as well. You know, it's not exactly planted, but I mean, it used to be like public enemy number one, but a lot of farmers just sort of letting it slide now a lot more.
Dock, another hard case. I agree. I don't think we'll ever see them love ragwort, though.
No. But actually, funnily enough, a mate of mine, John from Opotiki, an organic dairy farmer, he makes like a ragwort tea. And you know, when the seeds are dead or you know, whatever,
to get rid of it,
just chucks them all in a trough with water and then sprays it back over his paddocks.
Is that that's the biodynamic?
Yeah, it's the biodynamic side of things. Yeah,
and do you reckon it works? Have you watched?
he does. He says it's like adds copper back to the soil.
Yes,
that's his thing.
It is. Right. I mean, all those plants tell it. They're all there for a reason. They're all actually trying to balance the soil, which is, you know, if we observe more, you know, and learn more about some of those other plants. They do it. They tell you a lot. Weeds tell you heaps of what's going on in the soil.
It's a mindset change looking at it. You know, stuff like that.
We used to have loads of ragwort on our place when we first bought it, and actually the problem was the overgrazing and the pugging. As soon as we reduced the compaction and the pugging. I think we did like about 3 years of grubbing, but the most beneficial thing was like really cutting back, just changing the way we managed grazing so that we didn't heavily pug in the winter, because that ragwort just loves those little pockets of moisture to germinate in, and the seeds are viable for a long time. I might pull out a couple of ragworts a year. I think they're just blowing in.
There's always some around somewhere.
There's some, but it was interesting because we actually got notified by the regional council after we bought our place, because it's right on the roadside. We got one of those letters that said, you must control your ragwort. So we didn't want to spray, of course, so we were with the grubbers and, getting it out. But we made it into compost. We got it before it flowered.
Yeah.
The second year we got it before it flowered and made a compost, which, like your friend said, you know, the ragwort's high in copper, so, it's a good compost.
Yeah, okay. And I'll tell you what I've seen a lot more of lately, and I've had a thought. I don't know whether you might know this, but there's heaps and heaps of California thistle around now, where they hardly ever used to be, right? And I think, to me anyway, it's like a compaction thing I've heard, right? Once more, because they're all joined underground, right, to aerate the soil somewhat. And I just wonder if if there were more sort of fungally soils, would the myceliums and things like that actually be doing what the Kellys are? I've often wondered. I don't know. What do you reckon about that?
I'm not sure about that one. That would be interesting to, you know, ask a farmer who's managing pasture more. We did have a big patch of Kelly thistles, which, you know, we inherited along with ragwort. They still pop up now and then. Yeah, I still know that place, where they were, because there must be little fragments that, or seed perhaps, that pops up. But they're not widespread, but then we're gardening over that patch. We're not grazing. So I think that would be an interesting one for another person.
No, I was just thought about it.
That's managing sort of over, you know? Weeds organically. My dad was a farmer too. I grew up on a farm, and he used to get out there and mow the thistles before heavy rain.
Yes, yeah, I've heard that being still used today.
I'm not sure if it works for Cali thistles, but it did work because he didn't spray them.
Yeah,
And that was to get the water down into the rhizomes to rot out the roots.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Now that still gets used today. Especially for Kellys.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's like to drown them almost, sort of.
Yeah,
thing,
yeah. They rot. You know, you can kind of see it, the rot going in. But yeah, mycorrhizae stuff and weeds is a really specialist topic that actually I don't know so much about that.
Yeah,
you have to find another.
Find another organic brain to
maybe
pick about that
Mike
one.
Mike Moss. Does he still? I mean, he's not farming, but he must have.
Yeah.
He's got several decades of knowledge of pasture management.
Yeah.
Don't let it go to waste.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Get him back on the radio.
Use him while he's around. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Pick his brains. But yeah, compost, yeah, I know it's been used quite a lot on farms.
Yes.
And what would you suggest for, I guess, people maybe looking to move away from the conventional sort of style in a little steps? And like you said earlier, I think your compost could take the place of a lot of your synthetic fertilisers, things like that, couldn't it?
Yeah. Well, the thing with compost is you don't really want to replace the fertilizer with the compost. So you don't want to just keep piling on nitrogen via compost.
Mm.
What you want to do is build the soil functioning so that the soil is actually doing a lot of that work for you.
Mm.
So, you know, the soil microbes are super abundant and healthy, and they're bringing the nutrients into the soil to feed your plants.
Mm.
So, you know, soil microbes fix nitrogen. They can fix carbon as well. And that's the function of the compost is more around building the soil. You'll get a little bit of nutrients out of it, but if you're trying to replace nitrogen, NPK with compost, you just end up, you know, piling huge, many tons of it on, and you probably end up causing just as much pollution of waterways as well from the compost, because so really what you want to use, you know, it is a different practice, so you would use the compost more sparingly. You'd be attentive to, like, when you put it on to feed the microbes at the right time, and you're trying to build an environment in the soil that's the optimum for soil functioning. So that all your plants are healthy, they're getting as much as they can from the soil, they're actually living in association with a huge fungal population, worms underneath, all working away for you. A really good regenerative or organic farmer, the work is done in the soil a lot, and then you'll get healthier plants, so you then end up not having to use pesticides as much. So that's, you know, that's the way you can use compost, like solid compost like that. So I won't go into like application rates because I'm not super expert at that, but there'll be knowledge about application rates for different purposes. And then you know, another way to get the benefits from compost is to use compost tea.
Yes.
So I don't know if you've covered that at all in any other. Have you had any?
A few different ones, like the ragwort sort of tea and hay tea. I've discussed sort of briefly with people, But
compost tea is definitely more microbial.
Yeah.
So you make a good compost.
Yeah.
And then you multiply its beneficial effects by making a tea, which you then apply over your pastures or whatever, your vegetables, and that inoculates the soil with all those bugs that you want.
Nice.
As well as, it'll put a little bit of nutrients in there as well, but mainly it's the inoculation. And that's easily done, and there's a cool place over in Waihee called Chaos Springs.
Yes.
Have you come across them?
I've heard about them. I've been meaning to get over there and have a chat with someone from there, but I haven't yet, no.
Yeah,
but I have heard
of
them.
They do really interesting workshops. They've got a 200-hectare farm that they manage. So it's actually a functioning farm. And they supply equipment, so they've got all the sprays and the stirrers for making the brews.
Yeah,
the compost brews. And they do workshops, and they do workshops on quite a lot of different regenerative practices. I think they'd be really cool to check out and, you know, get them talking about what they do.
Yeah.
So that's another way of using compost.
Yeah.
So it's not compost just tea. About chucking it on. And then there's, you know, there's different kinds of compost. Like we've already said at Extreme, we've got two different kinds. And then there's, of course, worm castings.
Yes.
Which is a form of compost.
Yeah.
Yeah, which has been made by compost worms.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that stuff's amazing as well, because the worms' guts are just loaded up with all the beneficial microbes, fungi and bacteria that are beneficial to the soil functioning. So even though they're compost worms, they're not earthworms. So
they're mostly tiger worms, aren't they, mostly?
Tiger worm, their job in nature is to break down organic matter quickly, even quicker than an earthworm will do.
Right.
So earthworms are good as well. But you can utilize compost worms to process large amounts of organic matter and make a really great product, which you can then spread quite thinly over paddocks or gardens to, again, to like inoculate rather than fertilize.
I
think it's interesting to like get away from the idea of the fertilizing idea. You know, we really need to like build the soil. That's the answer. And and when we build the soil, we build the plant root structure. That's what's happening under the ground. That's what we're after. Is we want the plants to have super healthy roots, big root systems that go like way down in the soil. I don't have you talked to anyone else about that?
Yes, deep weeds. Deep roots and that.
Deep
for sure.
Rooting.
Yeah.
So worm casts and compost support that, especially worm casts.
Yeah,
and I did a little experiment when we were coming up with our composting at Extreme. We did the three kinds of compost. We were thinking of having a big worm system there, but we didn't go with that in the end. But we did make quite a lot of vermicast, which is what you call worm do's. Wormy stuff. And we went out to Kaifena Organics. And we asked them if we could have a couple of their beds, and we treated them with different of the different products. And then they put their usual veggies in, you know, courgettes and broccolis and lettuce and stuff like that. And then when the we had a look at their root systems, kind of when they were in the peak production, seemed a bit mean. But it wasn't a big area. It wasn't significant to their production. Like a special, you know, trial area. It was really noticeable how the worm casts, the plants grown in with the worm casts had huge roots.
Interesting.
Really extensive, lots of little tiny roots. Way bigger. I've got photos. Way bigger than just compost. I mean, we did, you know, a normal soil, no treatment. One as well, a control. So we had a bit of fun doing that. But yeah, that was the first time I'd ever done that. So there's definitely magic in the worm casts.
Yeah.
And, you know, for people, I was just having a quick look. You know, you can do worm vermicasting on farm.
I was just thinking that. It must be easy. You get an old bath or something like that, right? Or an old vat or whatever.
Or set up a windrow.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
You can do
set
it.
Up a row, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Have you ever visited My Nookie? The company My Nookie?
No, I visited a company, I can't remember their names, down in Taranaki when I was down there a couple of months ago.
Oh.
And they've got a big worm farming operation. Where was that? Maybe just out of Strathford or something?
Oh, cool.
I'm trying to remember their names. They've got massive long rows of worm, and they get lots of stuff brought into them. I think they get all the food scraps and that from New Plymouth Ways or something like that.
Mm.
And, yeah, various other stuff and, you know, old pellets and things like that, stuff that's not treated and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that all goes to feed the worms.
Mm.
Yeah, that was a big – I've actually got a sack of their stuff at home, which I haven't used yet. No, confirmed. Mm. They make pellets out of it.
Pelletizer.
Yeah, pelletize it.
Okay.
And, yeah, they do different mixes and things. But, yeah, I can remember the name of the place. And on that same trip, we had a look at Ausflow is the name of that other one, and there's like a chicken poo fertilizer place. The biggest mountain of chicken poo I've ever seen in my life. Huge, massive sort of shed, just full, you know. It's, I think it's all the Teagle chicken poo and that goes there. We mix them with the sawdust and everything like that, and they use that as fertilizer. But talking to a couple of the organic farmers at the thing, and it's, you get a lot of nitrogen, sure, and a lot of ammonia too. So, so a lot of them sort of dabble in it, but don't really use a lot of it. You know,
it's that thing of like using those materials like we do NPK.
Yeah, that's it.
Really, it's unbalancing to the soil to put it. Even if you've mixed it up with sawdust, unless you've composted it really well. You're gonna. They'll tend to be soluble, and it'll go out of the soil.
Yeah.
But yeah, chicken poo's very valuable because it's got phosphate in it. So we should. It's valuable. You know, we should be kind of catching it and getting it into compost. Because the other beautiful thing about compost, a good compost, a well mature compost, is that the nutrients get locked into the humus. So humus is, as compost gets older, and even in the soil, it turns into this stuff called humus, which is kind of weirdly like sort of like a jelly like stuff. But to feel it, you know, we just feel it like sticky brown stuff.
Sticky brown stuff. Yeah.
And it actually bonds nutrients to the molecules and then releases them slowly to plants via the mycorrhizae, though.
Yeah.
So the mycorrhizae are the fungi.
Yeah.
So it's the fungi that help the plants to get the nutrients. They're like the bridge between the soil and the plant in a healthy soil.
Yeah.
So how we farm with NPK fertilizer is we're just chucking it on. And the plants have to get it directly in solution through their roots. So it's almost like kind of hydroponic, but with some soil. But a real soil functioning. It's the fungus that connects with the roots and connects with the whatever clay particles or these humus material that's holding the nutrients.
Mm.
And those nutrients, they don't go out of the soil. They stay there, you know. And so then the plants can get to them.
Mm.
They travel along through the fungus and into the plant. It's pretty cool.
It's amazing, isn't it? Really?
Yeah. But we kill that fungus, you know, when we put pesticides and too much fertilizer and lime.
Yeah.
You know, we're just really it's a finely balanced system, and you know, I think it's. Once people see it in action, you know, farmers get to see it in action. It's hard to believe until you actually experience it. So, you know, hopefully there's the chance with more regenerative farmers coming on board that, you know, they can kind of demonstrate.
It seems to biodiversity seems to be the key sort of thing, right? The more different species of grasses and clovers and, you know, weeds, if you want to call them that, or whatever, and various things like that. And that, if you've got that kind of leads, seems to be anyway, leads to more biodiversity under the soil as well, all these things, and vice versa. Would you sort of go along with that one?
Yeah, because they've all got different root systems. They do have like preferences for minerals and things, like you were saying before about the ragwort taking up copper. And that's, you know, that's interesting biologically, I suppose. Yeah, is that I guess all those plants were meant to grow together like a forest. You know, a pasture can be like a mini forest with lots of different plants with lots of different functions. But the overall effect is that they cycle the nutrients through the system of growth and decay. And obviously some of it's taken off for grazing or whatever a little bit, but you know, you have to keep feeding the soil somehow. So yeah, having a range of plants is definitely going to be healthier for the soil and healthier for the animals perhaps that are eating it. And if it's, you know, if you think of it like a, we're healthier as well if we a diverse diet. If we just ate broccoli all the time, we probably would be really bored and not healthy, because we would be getting all the nutrients that we need. Yeah, I think healthy soil, you need the diversity above. So and more pasture.
And you're kind of building soil that way as well, right?
Yes.
You know, building the actual amount of soil more as you go along, right?
So I was thinking about that before I came down, and there's we talk about soil carbon. There's like two kinds of soil carbon. There's the surface, the biologically active, more active carbon, which is has lots of functions around like creating nutrients, decomposing, giving drought resistance because moisture can't get out of the soil as quickly, keeping it aerated as well, like having lots of soil in the surface carbon layers has those functions. So for crops, that's really important. And then there's another kind of carbon, which is further down the soil profile, and that's the sequestered carbon. When there's this people are talking about sequestering carbon.
Hear a lot about it.
So you can sequester carbon into the surface layers, but that's quite short term because it's in the it's highly oxygenated and it can burn off quickly. But the soil can sequester carbon further down the profile that lasts hundreds, if not thousands, of years, and it's this stable carbon. And it's quite low down.
Yeah.
And it comes from the roots of the plants.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's produced as a product of the plants feeding the fungus. So.
Right.
I don't know. Like, you know, we've said that the fungus gives the plants the nutrients from the clay, and then the plants actually exude stuff out of their roots, which feeds the fungus.
Right.
The fungus couldn't live there if the plant wasn't feeding it these sort it's called exudates.
Exudates.
We're getting nerdy now. I'm getting nerdy.
I like it. Exudates.
And that's got lots of carbon in it that the plant's bringing down through its big roots, because it's growing in a healthy soil, so big roots, and it could be a tree as well. It doesn't have to be grass or, you know, paddock. And that's the stuff that becomes stable. So it's probably like lots of dead fungal matter from all those fungus dying. And that stuff is in the lower end of the profile, and it stays there for a long time. So that's why it's really important to get those healthy root structures in the fungus. So we need it in the top as well to give us crops and production and stuff like that, but we need big, deep, healthy roots to get the carbon down low so it stays there for a long time.
Right on.
Mm.
I mean, that's got to be the dream, right?
So it all kind of ties together. Because we said we want healthy roots anyway to get the healthy tops. But it's really, really important to pay attention to root depth. And I think most regenerative farming would probably look at that. You know, if an advisor was visiting a farm that was trying to be regenerative, they probably would dig down and have a look how deep the roots are going.
Yeah.
So when it's quite, I love looking at soil profiles. I love digging holes and having a look what's going on down there. It's really interesting to me. But then
I enjoy that too. You see people walking around the spade and dig a hole. Oh well, what do you see here? Mm. And it's just like the smell and the feel and the root depth and you know, worm count and all sorts. You can pick up so much.
And you can see how deep the worms can go down. You know, the earthworms can go down really deep. Mm.
Which is great for the soil, right?
And that's the other thing. You want a good soil because the worms are like the unseen workers. They're just... If you can build up your worm populations, you're winning because you get aeration, permeability, so that you don't get surface runoff. You're not going to get so much compaction. The worms are mixing stuff up. They're taking organic matter down in the profile as well. And you can see that if you dig a hole and have a really good look. I like showing people that stuff. I like taking people who've never looked at soil before and digging a hole and going, look what's happening. Because it's right there in front of your eyes kind of thing. So it's pretty amazing what, you know, if we got everything working for us, it should be a lot easier.
It's working with, not against, once again,
working
isn't it?
With nature.
And, you know, like I say, letting the worms and the other, you know, the mycorrhizae, I should say, and things like that do the may, right? To a certain extent.
Then you've got, you know, clovers fixing nitrogen for us. You know, the atmosphere is just stuffed full of nitrogen. There's tons of it. I can't remember the percentage that the atmosphere is nitrogen. It's more than oxygen. You know, the more nitrogen-fixing plants we can get in our systems as well, the better. Trees, cover crops, you know, lupins and peas and beans and all those plants, they're just grabbing free nitrogen from the air. So I guess clover's still an important part of pasture management, is it?
Yes, a lot of clovers. Still,
it used to be super important. Do they keep on breeding new ones?
There seems to be a few more around than there used to be, but I think they've always been there, just haven't been widely used. What are some of them? Is it like I remember a mind blanky day today, but there's, of course, there's a few different types of red clovers, right? And what are some of the other ones? Not coming to me today, but clovers still heaps of
them. We used to get those farming newspapers in the mailbox.
Oh, yes.
Occasionally they're still, and I'd get one of those and have a quick look through, and there'd be ads for seed mixes with new clover names. I think they probably patent them, don't they? Trademark them
probably,
or something.
Yeah.
But you know, I think clover's good. Clover's a definitely important part of a system.
There was a subterranean clover or something as well. If I vaguely remember now, thinking about it.
Subterranean.
Something like that. The clovers. They're still. They're nice, as well to have around.
I think the biggest challenges is that grazing management, and managing your stock to look after the pasture and all its diversity.
It's
tricky, you know. Mm. I know it's hard stocking levels and when we get wet winters and stuff, you know, and the pugging's really bad, but that's probably one of the key practices to having a healthy soil and a healthy pasture. Overstocking, obviously not good.
Nah, not good.
Yeah.
But it seems to be two different sort of schools of thoughts that I've sort of observed anyway. You know, let everything grow really long and don't chew it right down to the ground, you know. a lot of talk about, you know, the longer it is on top, the longer the roots are below the soil, like you're talking about before. And then the other thing is like the trampling tactics, basically, where you just bring them in and just flatten it all into the ground,
yeah,
and break feed it like that, you know?
Yeah.
And it depends on who you're talking to, whether they say that builds up the soil more because everything's just basically trampled into the ground with, you know, cow poo or whatever and weeds and fertilise it and everything like that. But other folks, yeah, like, no, they don't want to do that. We just want to, you know, keep as much length and just graze it lightly sort of style. You know? So, but that's what's great about this sort of stuff. I mean, there's so many different ways you can sort of go about it, and it's very, I suppose, you just use your intuition or whatever, I suppose,
composting,
right?
Because that's called composting in situ. So that's when you're actually doing, like, you're creating the same processes as compost by poos and dead grass and stuff, and it's happening where you want it put. You know, you're not having to apply it because it's made right there using the worms and everything. So that system, I imagine, would build your worm population really well.
Yeah.
You might possibly push it a little bit to become acidic, maybe.
Yeah. You could be right, hey?
Maybe the cow poop. Because a good, healthy cow's guts are also like a earthworm gut. Yeah. They're full of amazing microbes that are beneficial to the soil. So if you've got healthy cows grazing that system, you should have a good breakdown.
It's all tight, isn't it?
Sure. Right. Some farmers would know, like anyone who's like observing it. Maybe checking the pH to see like what the long-term effects are. I could imagine a few things. Like you'd end up with some coarser grasses, eh? You'd definitely favour some of the coarser pasture rather than the rye grass.
Yeah, and if you, you know, we'll get a few of the seeds and then, of course, get trampled on the ground and then come back up again, of course, for various things. But I think mostly in that style it's like 90 to 120 days sort of rotation. So you don't do it once every, three or four months. Some guys have been talking to have done it like that. So.
Yeah. But, you know, have you tried any on your place?
Nah. Well, I don't actually have a place at the moment. That's the thing, yeah.
Okay.
That's where I'm at, but yeah. We'll see what happens in the future. But yes.
Right.
Yeah. Working on it. Okay. I'm working on it, yeah. Anyway, what is it? We better wrap it up.
I think so. That's enough nerding out.
And yeah, thanks very much for coming on the show, Liz. Appreciate that. And you've got certified compost, I forgot to say, which I was going to, haven't you, as well? That's another thing with the extreme. It's a certified compost.
Well, it's meets the national compost standards.
Right.
So in that way, it's certified. It's not like BioGrow certified.
Yeah. Okay.
By any. Because it's really expensive to get those accreditations, and I don't think...
Yeah, a lot more paperwork too.
We don't have enough people who... I don't think we have enough customers. I've asked a few customers when I'm up there, like, would it make a difference to you if it was BioGrow certified or not? And most of them say, oh, no, I can see what you're putting in there.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of get to see it being made. So we haven't gone down that track. But we would, but we've been looking at one kind of a validation system that we might look into. But yeah, it meets the trading standards for compost. So that means that it has the nitrogen, the calcium, the magnesium, the phosphate, the carbon nitrogen ratio as per the national composting standards.
Okay.
Which I don't have a copy of with me right now.
Yeah, all right.
Okay. I'm happy to share at the clinic sessions next week.
Next week.
What I will do is I'll bring, because we send our stuff to get, we send it off to Hills Lab about twice a year.
Okay.
We do like a representative sample of three of the products at least and send them off to get compost profile, which is... you know, all the things that are important in a compost. Not the microbes, just the nutrients, though. What I'll do is I'll bring those up with me, and then anyone that wants to talk about that kind of thing, I'll show them where we're at.
There you go, folks. There's a Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, is it?
Yeah.
From 12:30 to 4:30 12:30 to 4:30 So yeah, go up and have a chat with Liz, and if you get your timing right,
you can get free worms.
Yeah, get some free worms.
If I'm already showing someone else around, then we'll just jump in. You know, you can just jump in. It's very casual.
Nice, nice. Yeah, yeah. All right, folks, so that's Monday the 6th, isn't it? Monday 6th, 7th and 8th next week for the international, well, the Whangarā-style compost week. Lots of happenings happening. Check out the Growers' Good Guide and, lots of stuff happening.
The theme this year for the compost week, which we've never quite embraced like we have this year, is compost nature's climate champion.
Ooh. Catchy.
So, catchy.
Compost nature's climate champion.
Yeah, we're focusing on how compost can help address climate change, which we kind of have through our chat today.
Yes, we do. Yes, we have.
You know, helping agriculture. How can we change our agriculture and even our veggie growing at home?
Yeah.
I came across a website from the States, and it was about using compost and stuff, and they were actually using the term climate gardening.
Nice. Yeah, okay.
So that's a new term.
A new one, yeah.
Where you're
I like your one better. Yeah.
As a thing, you know, oh, I'm a climate gardener, you know, or I'm a climate farmer. You know, it says something about what you believe in anyway.
For
you know,
sure,
what
you're
trying to do, that you're consciously trying to do something for the climate by.
Yeah, it's a value sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure, yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks very much. Okay. We're going to wrap it up. Thanks again for coming on the show. That's it for the show today, folks. Hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back in next week. Ka kite.